We'll move to our next case this morning. And it is Brandon Marcure versus Tyler Lynn. All right, I see both counsel, and can you both hear me?
Yes.
All right, great. Is it Scopel?
Stotchpole, Your Honor.
Stotchpole, all right, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Michael Stotchpole on behalf of plaintiff appellant Brandon Marcure. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
We are here today because of a clerical mistake. Mr. Marcure filed a response to the police defendant's motion to dismiss, but he forgot to sign it. And that small oversight took on outsized significance in this case because of two distinct errors that the district court committed, each of which independently warrants reversal here. First, the district court improperly struck Mr. Marcure's brief under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 11 without considering whether that error caused any prejudice to the defendants. And second, the district court then improperly granted the police defendant's motion to dismiss without considering its merits. Now, I'd like to begin with the Rule 11 issue because I think the common ground on that issue all but resolves this appeal. Two important points appear to be undisputed here. First, it seems to be undisputed that the district court had discretion to overlook the missing signature. And in addition, it similarly is undisputed that in exercising its discretion, the district court should have considered whether the defendant suffered any prejudice from the lack of a signature. That is enough to reverse here because the district court did not conduct that analysis or apply that standard. Instead, it understood Rule 11 to require striking the brief on the basis of the missing signature.
It's easy to understand why the judge was operating under that understanding, because that's what the rule says.
Your Honor, I think the judge was right to pay heed to the text of Rule 11, and I think it focused on the word must in Rule 11A. But there's at least one competing must that the district court should have taken into account. And that's Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 61, which says that at all stages of the proceedings, the district court must disregard all errors and defects that do not affect any party's substantial rights. So I think that was one consideration that should have led the district court to temper its action here. And in addition, I think reading Rule 11A in the full context of Rule 11 makes clear that the error here was a purely technical defect. The presence or absence of the signature on Mr. Marcure's brief was not relevant to the district court's ability to enforce the substantive provisions of Rule 11. And I don't think there's been any question raised here by either defendants or the district court that there were any concerns about Mr. Marcure's response on that score.
Well, the signature has substantive effect for sanctions, and it's an attestation that the party or attorney represents that the arguments are made in good faith based on the facts and the law.
Well, Chief Judge Sykes, I don't think the signature is necessary for that purpose, because under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 11B, also filing or otherwise advocating the motion had the exact same effect. So just based on what Mr. Marcure has already filed here, the district court was fully able to enforce the substantive provisions of Rule 11.
But the signature requirement is not insignificant.
And the rule also says for the signature requirement that it must be signed. So Rule 11A has two musts that are mandatory.
Your Honor, as I said, I think there are musts in Rule 11A that the district court was right to take account of. It just simply should have taken account of some of the other musts in the federal rules, and in particular, the requirement to consider whether there's any practical effect of an error. And I think that may be why I don't believe we've heard any dispute from the other side that the district court had discretion to overlook the error here.
I'm not sure the other side has said that, but we can confirm that when we hear from Mr. Ron, but I'm not sure they've agreed to that.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I think many district courts commonly do overlook errors of this type and consider the merits anyway. And I think that's consistent with the spirit of the federal rules. And I think, although it's certainly not the case, we're not suggesting that Rule 11A, the signature requirement, is in some way insignificant. But as this court said in the Kovalich Construction Company case, rules express policies of differing importance. The need to deter noncompliance varies, and the consequences of failure to comply differ. And I think that was the spirit in which the district court failed to consider whether to exercise its discretion to overlook the
over- That case didn't have anything to do with an unsigned meeting. So that discussion is dicta.
Well, Your Honor, the court...
Could you speak up a little bit? I don't know why, but... Your voice is not coming through.
Yeah, I think you are standing away from your microphone, so your voice is soft.
Yes, Your Honors, is this better?
A bit, yeah.
I'm sorry, could you remind me what the question was?
The question is, the Kovalich case discussion that you're referring to doesn't have anything to do with what was at issue in that case. There wasn't an unsigned pleading in that case. There was a failure to file a disclosure statement of some kind. So it was a discussion in dicta about the requirements of Rule 11, sort of by way of analogy. It wasn't, it's so not a holding. So let's just go to the case before that's important here, and that is Kasabowski.
Sure. Well, one thing I do think is important to note from the Kovalich case, it did note that there was a signature on the brief in that case, although it did go on to discuss how Rule 11 would apply if the error there had been tantamount to the absence of any signature whatsoever. And the important principle I think it laid down there is it's undisputed that in that case, the error was not corrected. And this court in that case still considered the presence or absence of prejudice as being relevant.
Okay, and maybe I should step back a little and ask the more important global question, which is our case law, Kasabowski and Kovalich Construction, out of step with the text and proper understanding of Rule 11? I was in law school when these amendments to Rule 11 were adopted, and this was like a major big deal, sea change in procedural law to require a signature, and the force of the attestation that the signature provides that the appropriate inquiry into the facts and law had been accomplished and that the pleading was well-grounded in facts and law. So I question whether our case law, both Kasabowski and Kovalich, are sound interpretations of Rule 11.
Well, Your Honor, for the reasons I've discussed, I think they are sound interpretations because they place the rule in the broader context of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And although they certainly give district courts ample discretion to consider all the circumstances of the case, they do require district courts to recognize that they have some discretion in how they apply the rule.
I don't understand how you're reading that into the rule that says must, and even the committee notes to the rule support that it's mandatory. So just from a plain reading of the text, I don't think you get around the mandatory nature of this.
Understood, Your Honor. Well, I think I've addressed the reasons why we think that there was necessary to be at least some tempering of the mandatory language based on other considerations in the federal rules. But I think it's important to note that even if you think that the district court acted properly in striking the brief here, it still committed reversible error when it then further granted the motion to dismiss with prejudice merely because at that point there was no response on file. And so turning to that question, it's important to stress that it is the movement's burden under Rule 12b-6 to persuade the district court that the complaint fails to state a claim. That is why this court said in Bolt v. Loy that the mere failure to file a response to a Rule 12b6 motion is not a sufficient basis for dismissal. A plaintiff is entitled to stand on the complaint alone. Here, the district court applied its local Rule 7.1b2 to hold otherwise, but that was plainly improper under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 83, which forbids any application of a local rule that would bring it into conflict with the federal rules. The district court created such a conflict here by relieving defendants of their burden under Federal Rule 12b6.
I'm not even sure that the local rule is in conflict with the rules of civil procedure, because the local rule just says that the court is entitled to disregard a pleading that is stricken and can rule accordingly, but it doesn't lift the obligation to actually address the contents of the motion that has been filed. So I don't see a textual conflict between the two rules. There seems to be a conflict between the way the district court applied the local rule in not taking the second step of the analysis to actually address the contents of the motion on their face. But again, I don't see a conflict between the two rules.
Yes, Chief Judge Hicks. So we're not arguing that the rule on its face or in all of its applications is in conflict with the federal rules. I think the text of the rule itself is somewhat ambiguous. It says the district court may presume there's no opposition to the motion. And I think it's unclear whether that means presume that there is no brief that is going to be filed in opposition to the motion, or presume that there's no substantive opposition to the motion. And many district courts in the Central District of Illinois routinely apply the rule in the way that Your Honor was describing. But whether the rule on its face conflicts with the federal rules, or as applied by the district court conflicts with the federal rules, does not affect the analysis. Neither of those two things is permissible.
Would it matter if the district court had dismissed the case without prejudice? Or dismissed those claims without prejudice?
That would certainly be better, Your Honor, and more consistent for the reasons the Judge Griffith's opinion in the Cohen case for the DC Circuit explained. But it doesn't resolve the conflict with the federal rules. I don't think even the Cohen case explained how simply making the dismissal without prejudice isn't also relieving the defendants of their burden to show that the complaint failed to state a claim.
The First Circuit has come out differently. As you identified in your brief, the other circuits to address this question have come out the way you're arguing. Is it your position that the First Circuit just got it wrong and they only looked at the text and didn't rely on the burdens that have been developed under the law?
Essentially, Your Honor, and with great respect for the First Circuit, yes, we do believe that in this narrow respect, their case law is out of step with the federal rules of civil procedure. And I think that's particularly clear in this circuit because of the GCIU Employers Retirement Fund case, which we cite at page 26 of our brief, which makes clear that a conflict exists even if the interpretation of the federal rule is not evident on the text of the rule itself. This court's established precedents interpreting the rules override any conflicting application of the local rules as well. If there are no further questions at this time, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
That's fine. Mr. Ron.
Hey, please, the court. I find myself in a somewhat unusual position here, defending a position that we didn't assert in the district court. We were and remain eager to argue that Mr. McGuire's complaint should fail as a matter of law, as inadequately and frankly incomprehensibly pled. The appellant argues that the signature requirement of Rule 11A is discretionary and that it's an abuse of discretion to apply the rule by its express terms. Well, we've already established the express terms say the court must strike an unsigned paper. The only discretion that that sentence contemplates is what constitutes a prompt correction of that. And I would suggest that's where the severe prejudice standard could come in, that if a correction occurs before the opposing party suffers severe prejudice, the correction should be allowed. Here, however, it was never corrected. And the district court ruled nearly a year later, and during that year period, the plaintiff continued to file pleadings and motions in other aspects of the case, including notably a motion for summary judgment against private attorney Knoll. The plaintiff argues that the court can't assume that an argument that is apparently abandoned is actually abandoned. I think the court has every right to assume that arguments that are waived are actually waived, and that the court does not bear the burden of guessing whether a party has waived an argument because they meant to or because they just forgot about it. If a plaintiff sues parties A and B, and parties A and B move to dismiss that complaint on separate grounds, and the plaintiff responds only to party B's arguments, I think the court is entitled to assume that the plaintiff has abandoned his arguments against party A, and is reasonable in concluding that the that argument was waived. So I think in this case it's perfectly appropriate for the court to have assumed that because Mr. Marcure did not correct his error, that was a legal waiver of that. However, even if the court were required to address the motion to dismiss on its merits and the complaint on its merits, I think it's obvious, and this court can affirm a case on any grounds in the record, and I think it's fairly obvious that this case does not state an actionable claim. As best I can interpret,
Mr. Rahm, before you get to the subject matter and the merits of the motion to dismiss, your argument on the motion to dismiss that the court, if a response isn't filed, is free to grant it without objection would conflict with our clear case law on summary judgments, which are similar. Why would it be okay to say, well, for summary judgments, if you don't file a response, the court still has to consider the merits without the response, but for motions to dismiss, that doesn't apply?
I think the distinction here is that it constitutes a waiver if they don't directly respond to an argument. In this
but
case,
we have not we haven't said in the summary judgment context that you are waiving your right to have the court determine on the merits. I agree, if you don't file a response, then you don't get to put in a response, or the court doesn't have to consider what your arguments are. But in the summary judgment context, the court still has to evaluate whether or not you're entitled to summary judgment based on the moving party's submission. So what's different about 12b-6 compared to Rule 56 that would relieve the court of that requirement?
I don't know that there is necessarily a distinction in that regard. I think in this case, there were simply so many parties that were joined, and that the court merely interpreted that a failure to respond as a abandonment, a failure to prosecute one portion of his case.
But that wasn't the basis. It wasn't a, and I know there's case law where we say if you fail to prosecute, you can dismiss the case. But there was never any warning along those lines. And he was still prosecuting other aspects of the case. So I don't think we could go down that route.
Well, as we're sitting here, I can't come up with a distinction for you in that regard. To the extent that the court failed to specifically address the adequacy of the complaint, I think that that error, if it existed, was harmless in this case, because the complaint itself is incomprehensible in what it alleges the police conspired with his defense attorneys and two separate prosecutors to violate his rights in a case that as of today is still waiting trial in the state court. So I think that the motion to dismiss on its merits is well received, and I would urge that the district court's decision be affirmed on that ground, and to the extent any error in considering on the merits, it was harmless. And unless the court has further questions, I would rest.
Thank you very much. Mr. Scotchpaw?
Thank you, Chief Judge Sykes. I'd like to try to make two points quickly. Just first, I think picking up on Judge St. Eve's question, I think it's exactly right that this court and others endeavor to treat this the same in the summary judgment context and the motion to dismiss context. And we cite at pages 22 to 23 of our opening brief some of this court's summary judgment.
I am still having a real problem of hearing you. I'm not sure why.
Sure.
I can hear Judge Sykes very well.
I'm sorry, Judge Bannon. I'll speak up. We cite some of this court's summary judgment case law, which we think is very clear on this point. And just to the notion that Mr. Marcure, that there was either any forfeiture or failure to waiver or failure to prosecute here, I think that's just flatly inconsistent with the record. Mr. Marcure did attempt vigorously to oppose this motion to dismiss, and his brief was stricken only for the lack of a signature. And it's not consistent with this court's opinion in Bolt v. Loy, which considered exactly the argument that defense counsel is making and said that you can't just assume that it's an abandonment. It's equally likely that they're standing on the complaint. And finally, just very briefly to address the merits, I think there are a number of reasons to doubt that the defendants carried their burden here. The complaint attached extrinsic documents, and they didn't explain why that was appropriate on a 12b6 motion. They made a statute of limitations argument that didn't apply to all of the defendants. And on the Fourth Amendment claim, they rely in particular on extrinsic documents, a consent to search form, without explaining why that's appropriate. And then just finally, to the question earlier, at a bare minimum, there was prejudice here because the dismissal was with prejudice and not without prejudice. And had the district court considered the merits, it would have been required to assess whether there was whether it would be appropriate for Mr. Marcure to replead.
All right. Thank you very much. Our thanks to both counsel and Mr. Scotchpaw. Particular thanks to you and your law firm for your willingness to accept this representation of the plaintiff pro bono. You have the thanks of the court.